Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Text number 51. Ata kim svarupam tadvastu tatvam ityatraha vadanti tat tatvavidas tatvam yajnanam advayam iti jnanam chideka rupam advayatvam chasya svayam siddha tadvisha tadvisha tatvantara bhavat Svashaktyeka sahaya twat paramashrayam tam vina tasam asiddha twat cha tatvam iti parama purusharta dyotanaya paramasukha rupa tvam tasya bodhyate ata eva tasya nitya tvam cha darshitam shri sutaha. In answer to the question, what is the identity of that substantial truth? These words are spoken. Those who know that tattva call it non-dual consciousness. Here, consciousness means that which is purely spiritual. That tattva is non-dual in the sense that no other independently manifested tattvas exist, similar to it or dissimilar. That it takes assistance only from its personal energies, and that none of these those energies come into being separately from this ultimate basis of existence. And because the word tattva also implies the ideal of the final goal of human life, this tattva is understood to embody the highest happiness. This also indicates that its existence is eternal. The verse under discussion was spoken by Sri Sutta. Commentary. Here Sri Jiva takes the definition of the absolute truth one step further. The supreme tattva is jnanam advayam, the original perfect consciousness, the unity underlying all existence. Jnana in this context of Srimad Bhagavatam does not mean consciousness devoid of subject and object, and Advaya does not deny the presence in the absolute truth of transcendental form and variety. Rather, Jnana indicates manifesting exclusively as living spirit. All of the Supreme Person's direct expansions and all of his internal energies are fully conscious. Gunaik Swarupa Bhuta is tu. Gunyasau Harir Ishwaraha. Lord Hari, the absolute controller, possesses his own qualities. Those qualities are inherent aspects of his essential spiritual nature. So the previous Anuccheda discussed from the second verse of the Bhagavad Dhamma, the most general understanding of the tattva, now that is made more specific in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Dhamma, in the words of Sutta Goswami, jnanam advayam, and then it's understood in three aspects, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Jnanam advayam, this can be misunderstood by Advaitavadis. These are words that attract them, especially the word Advaya or Advaita, and the word Jnanam. Oh boy. Hare Krishna. We can say that this was intentional, that it was said in such a way so that the Mayavadis would be confused and not properly understand the purpose of the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam doesn't reveal itself to the faithless. The non-devotees can read the Bhagavad Gita, and they won't understand the actual purport. Especially if they read it without a proper commentary. Here's Jiva Goswami's commentary on this verse. He continues, or rather the commentary continues, "The absolute tattva is adwaya in the sense that nothing exists independently from him. Nothing in his own category of Vishnu tattva, his personal expansions and incarnations. Nothing in the transcendentally congruent category of Swarup Shakti tattva, his internal energies. And nothing in the separated categories of Jiva tattva, the marginal energy composed of finite living beings, and Maya tattva, the material world. Nothing in any of these categories exists separately from the supreme tattva. Each of these other tattvas is dependent on him in every way. He is the very substance from which they emanate, the designer and impeller of their manifestation, and their constant sustainer. Thus we can say that only he exists, but this Advaita reality is always joined by his unlimited personal forms and the infinite varieties of existence expanding from him." Srila Baladeva Vibhushan comments that Swayam Siddha means self-manifest. Only the Advaita Tattva himself is Swayam Siddha. Everything else is manifested from him. Just as an ascetic sage may be called Swayam Dasa, his own servant, to point out that he never takes service from anyone else, the Advaita personality of Godhead is said to manifest himself independently of all other creators and controllers. Neither the finite living souls nor material nature has a claim to such an independent status. Even while the Supreme takes help from his personal energies, he remains Advaita, non-dual. That the Supreme, though assisted by his energies, is non-dual, implies that he is independent, just as King Pandu's being called Danur Dvitiya, he whose assistant was his bow, implies that no other person assisted the king. Why is the Supreme indicated here only as consciousness and not only as pleasure? Even the Upanishads mention bliss as an essential quality of Brahman, Vijnanam Anandam Brahma, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. In the opinion of Srila Baladeva Vibhushana, the word tattva here implies the blissfulness of the Supreme. The primary meaning of tattva is the essence of something's being. In general, the essence of all things is happiness. Because everyone strives for happiness, and for this purpose, all objects are used. So the people, their purpose in life is happiness, all living beings, and even the non-living entities are meant to be used by living entities for their happiness. Certainly, the original being, Brahman, also enjoys bliss. It might be argued that consciousness and bliss are passing events, not permanent states of being. But Srila Jiva Goswami refutes this by reasoning that because the Supreme Tattva is self-manifesting, it is eternal. Sad akaranam yat tad nityam. I don't know where this comes from. I can't find the source, but it's an important statement. Whatever has real existence without being caused by something else must be eternal. Doesn't have a beginning, doesn't have a cause, it must be eternal. Thus, Srimad Bhagavatam conveys its own denotative relationship with the Supreme Truth. The Supreme Truth is that which the Bhagavatam describes. So, the main focus of the Tattva Sandarbha, of the Sandarbhas, all six Sandarbhas, is devotional service to Krishna. The last three Sandarbhas are about Krishna, The last two are about his devotional service. But the other aspects of the Supreme Truth are dealt with, Brahman and also Paramatma. So there's no separate Brahma Sandarbha, but actually the Brahma Sandarbha is included within the Tattva Sandarbha and part of the Bhagavat Sandarbha. So the generic aspect, impersonal aspect of the Supreme is being discussed here and will be discussed at the beginning of the Bhagavat Sandarbha. In defining Bhagavan, he will be contrasted with what is Paramatma and Brahman. So Brahman will be explained. But there's not much to say about Brahman. Most of the things we can say about Brahman are negative characteristics. It's not like this and not like that. Okay, any discussion, but try to keep it to the actual topics of the Anucheda. Let's not get too far off, otherwise you lose focus and some devotees are not happy with that. Okay, comments?
No? Yes? It was stated that the tattva means blissful consciousness. We equated tattva with bliss, but we know that...
Not that the word tattva means bliss, tattva. But it's logically implied.
Logically implied, yeah. So the connection is with bliss. But at the same time, we know that the very svarupa, the jaya svarupa, hai Krishna Ranitya Dasa.
Yes.
That from one point of view, we are created in order to be happy, and from another point of view, we are servant, and service means selfish service when we don't accept, when expect anything in return, we just want to give. So well, how to put it together?
Well, different people may have different conceptions of happiness. For someone, happiness is 3 scoops of ice cream. So if I ask him, would you like to be happy? Or if I ask the same person, would you like 3 scoops of ice cream? It's equivalent. It's not 2 different things. Now, the living entities in general, their sarupa is to be Krishna's eternal servant. And then the alternative idea is that their essence of their existence is to be happy. But they're not 2 different things. They're not 2 different things. Eternal happiness is found in being Krishna's servant, and vice versa. If you're Krishna, if you're eternally happy, you must be Krishna's servant. You can't be happy otherwise, at least not for permanently. And if you're acting as Krishna's servant, you have to be happy. You're not really serving Krishna if you're not happy. So they're not different. It's not one or the other. It's actually always both of them together. Just 2 different descriptions of the same condition. And it's not even different activities. There's the same person doing different activities. No. Being happy and serving Krishna involve the same activities and the same consciousness. So what's different? If the activity is the same and consciousness is the same, what else do you have? Just besides your consciousness and your activities, there's nothing left. So, what you are and what you feel and what you do, what you feel and what you do when you're serving Krishna and what you feel and what you do when you're happy are exactly the same.
So, we can define that it's a state of consciousness of being Krishna's servant in which one can experience real happiness.
Yes. Yes. It's also the actual experience, not just the thinking about being Krishna's servant, but the actual experience of doing it. Yeah. Yes. Anything else? Yes, Dharma.
this in the translation, that tattva is non-dual in the sense that no other independently manifested tattvas exist similar to it or dissimilar. Oh. It makes sense.
Oh, well, okay, see, there's difference. Different kinds of difference. There's difference. You're a brahmachari, but you're somewhat different than some other brahmachari. You know, not all the brahmacharis are exactly the same. So that's swagata beda. Difference of members of the same category. But you're different than a horse in various ways. And that's a different category. So that's a difference among things in a different category. And then you have variety within yourself. You're happy today and yesterday you were unhappy. Although you're not two different people. Not even two different brahmacharis. You're the same one brahmachari. But you have differences within yourself. So you have differences within yourself. I'm sorry, what that is swagata beda. And then sajatiya beda is difference from other members of the same category. And then difference with dissimilar things. Similar, dissimilar, and also same. Difference from yourself. I'm different than I was yesterday. Okay? Yeah.
Jnana in this context of Shrimad Bhagavatam does not mean consciousness devoid of subject and object. Can you elaborate on this?
Devoid of subject? Well, that, I mean, in other words, it's not the way the Mayavadis take it. Jnanam Advayam. So it's not just dual knowledge. Like, I notice that there's a fly on the wall. Well, that's duality. There's a fly on the wall, not an elephant. You know, and it's on the wall, not on my head. Yeah, you know, so there's duality. That's dvaya jnanam. But we're distinguishing a different kind of jnanam, advaya jnanam. Now, the Mayavadis think that means the kind of knowledge where there's no knower, where there's no known, and there's no process of knowing. It's just pure consciousness doing nothing, and nobody's doing it. So we're denying that. We're denying the Mayavadi interpretation of jnana. Okay.
So if you could kindly remind what was the previous definition of the Absolute Truth with Jiva Goswami.
It was the definition made. that was derived from the second verse of the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. It's really just Vedyam Vastavam. It's some real thing with its many qualities. You know, Vastava means it possesses with all the things that are connected with it. So that doesn't make it very specific. And also it's knowable. Suppose there was an absolute truth that's not knowable. Then there's no sense studying it. You can't know it. But we say this is a significant thing. First of all, there is an absolute truth. That's a radical statement. Many people won't accept that. And then we say there's an absolute truth and it's knowable. And it has qualities. So that's what we get out of the second verse. Ram? Yes.
I want to ask something. I don't know if it's in the range of the... I was thinking maybe the easiest way is if you can just tell if somebody is asking something, you can say that it's outside the range of the...
Okay, it sounds like it's going to be.
I was just thinking about this. What is the verse that you quoted that Brahman has Ananda? Then it's not possible.
Not has Ananda, but is Ananda.
Is Ananda.
Yeah, difference.
Then it means that there must be some difference between the knower. I mean, there must be a knower to know this Ananda.
No, the same thing. Ananda is just a special kind of knowledge. So we're already, Mayavadis are already saying that transcendental knowledge, the knowledge that is the absolute truth, according to Upanishads, doesn't have a knower. Doesn't have a separate person who knows. You can say, well, what kind of knowledge is that supposed to be? That's a good question. It's a weird kind of knowledge. In fact, there is no such thing. A knowledge that doesn't have a knower. But they say it is. And then Ananda is just a special kind of awareness. Now see, the word, Sanskrit word jnana, we translate as knowledge. The English word is not really the same thing. Knowledge is the act of knowing something. And would you say it's knowledge to know that there's an elephant on the wall? There isn't. It's a mistake. There's a fly. That's not an elephant. That's a fly. So my awareness of an elephant on the wall is not knowledge. In English, we don't call that knowledge. We call that misunderstanding. So in English, the word knowledge means correct understanding. The Sanskrit word jnana is broader. It means all kinds of awareness. And if you want to talk about correct awareness, then we call it pramana or prama. So we have to be careful with the word jnana. It means any awareness. But Mayavadi say that the awareness that is Brahman, not the awareness that Brahman has, because Brahman doesn't have qualities, so it can't have jnana as a quality. It is jnana, supposedly, and that jnana cannot be a dualistic knowledge that separates itself into knower, knowing, and known. Advaya jnanam, they take it very literally. And bliss is just another kind of consciousness. You may not think of bliss as knowledge. You know, knowledge is what you get tested on. You don't get tested on bliss. You know, if I can't answer the question, then it shows I don't have knowledge. It's not measuring my bliss. Now, maybe there's some other way to test bliss and give you a score for it. But not normal factual questions don't measure bliss. So you don't think that bliss is knowledge, but you're thinking in the English word knowledge. When you deal with the term jnanam, consciousness or awareness, certainly bliss is a kind of awareness. It's just a special kind of jnana. So what's true for jnana should also be true for the special jnana, which is bliss. The Mayavadis say that the jnana of Brahman doesn't divide into knower and known, and so also the ananda of Brahman doesn't have an experiencer or thing experienced. It's another kind of jnana. But that's the Mayavadi view, and we reject it. Dhamadhar?
Because this tattva is known as advayam, therefore, because of that, it's eternal. Being classified as advayam is eternal.
Well, okay.
Because
nothing else exists. So yeah. Nothing could be its cause. Nothing
so
else. It might be its own cause, and therefore we call it swayam siddha. Its own cause, whatever that means. But that's just a little funny because just call it its own cause, because cause means being created by something else. The other thing existed first, and then the product came later. That's the ordinary definition of cause. So how can the eternal absolute truth be its own cause? It's not caused at all, actually. But it's called Swayam Siddha, self-manifest. If it's so, or it's Advaya, let's say, if we know it's Advaya, that there is nothing else, then how can it have a cause? Because a cause has to be another thing, an actual cause. So there is no other thing, therefore there's no cause of Brahman. So, and what doesn't have a cause is, the philosophers say, must be eternal. Therefore, Brahman's eternal. Because there is nothing else than Brahman, therefore nothing can be its cause, and therefore it's eternal. So, it doesn't have a beginning or a cause, it's eternal. And it doesn't have an end, nothing's going to destroy Brahman. We can destroy illusion, but we can't destroy Brahman. So it's eternal. No beginning, no end. That's eternal. If something doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, and also it exists in the middle. If something didn't have a beginning, didn't have an end, but doesn't exist in the middle, then it's not eternal. A square triangle doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, but also it doesn't have a middle. So that's just absolutely non-existent. But Brahman exists. Some other, some Buddhists may say that even Brahman doesn't exist. That there's no things. But the Advaitavadis say Brahman exists eternally. No, but no beginning and no end, so it's eternal. If you establish that something does exist, But it has no beginning and no end, then it's an eternal. It exists eternally then. Because to not be eternal means to have a beginning or an end or both. Okay, yes?
I have another question about tattva. The primary meaning of tattva is the essence of something's being.
Well, okay, the tattvam, adding the suffix on the word tat. Tat just refers to that, whatever that is. It can have any antecedent.
Okay.
And, you know, you're talking about something and you call it tat, that. The thing you're talking about. It's within that. A context of talking about something. Then in the next sentence you could call that thing tat, right?
Yeah.
There's a pronoun referring to something... Something that you've referred to already. And then if you add the suffix twa, it means the condition of being that. Or the essential condition, the essence of what it means to be that. That's the tatvam.
So this means, so we apply this, and from this we'd say that the essence of every being is happiness.
Well, do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the subject of the Bhagavatam is the happiness of the Supreme Lord? Can we say that?
What is?
Can we say that tattva is to understand the happiness, the enjoyment of Krishna?
Yeah, that's Chaitanya Upanishad says, atato ananda mimamsa. What we really have to focus our study on is ananda. Want to understand the absolute truth? You should understand what ananda is.
Thank you.
Sure.
So the supreme truth is the happiness of the Supreme Lord.
Well, the Supreme Lord is the absolute truth, and he has his happiness. But he's not separate from his happiness. Also his activities, also his form, also his devotees, not only his happiness, these other things too. But they're all connected with his happiness. It's not like you can abstract the happiness and throw away the person. You know, I'll just distill the happiness and then we don't need Krishna anymore. Not like that. Sure. Anything else? Okay, we can do 52. Nanu nila pityadya karam kshanikam eva gyanam drishnam. Tatpunar advayam nityam gyanam katam lakshyate. Yan nishnam idam shastram ityaha. Sarva Vedanta Saram Yad Brahmatmai Katva Lakshanam Vastvadvatiyam Tannishtam Kaivalyaika Prayojanam. But one may object, but awareness, jnana, is only a momentary, see now I'm translating jnana as awareness, is only a momentary phenomenon temporarily marked by various forms. Blue objects, yellow objects, and so on. Can I look back at the previous anuccheda, how I translated jnana? Consciousness. So I'm careful here. I realized when we were in the middle of editing that I was translating jnana sometimes as knowledge and sometimes as consciousness, and it's inconsistent. So I made it has got to be either consciousness or awareness because they're pretty much the same, but don't translate it as knowledge. And that's what I think I did consistently in this section. Let's see. Anyway, again, reading the translation. One may object, but awareness, jnana, is only a momentary phenomenon, temporarily marked by various forms, blue objects, yellow objects, and so on. How, then, can the subject matter of this scripture be identified as jnana, defined as being non-eternal, non-dual, and eternal? Knowledge, as far as we know it, is dual, and it changes, it's temporary. So what is this jnana that's non-dual and eternal? What can it be? In answer, it is said, and the answer is given in a verse from the 12th canto, 13th chapter. This Bhagavatam is the essence of all Vedanta philosophy, because its subject matter is the absolute truth, which, while non-different from the spirit soul, is the ultimate reality, one without a second. The goal of this literature is exclusive devotional service unto that supreme truth. Okay, Continuing. Satyam jnanam anantam brahma iti yasya surupam uktam yena shutam shutam bhavati iti yad vijnanena sarva vijnanam pratigyatam sadeva somyedam agra asit iti adina nikila jagareka karanata tadaikshita bahu syam ityanena satya sankalpata chayasya pratipadita tena brahmana swarupa shakti bhyam sarva brihattamena sardham anena jivena jivena atmaneti tadiyoktav idanta nirdeshena tato binatvaipi atmata nirdeshena tad atmamsha visheshatvena labdasya badadayana samadhi drishta yuktir atya binata rahitasya jivatman jivatmano yadekatvam tattvamasi ityadau gyata tadamsha bhuta chid rupatvena samana karata tadeva lakshanam pratamato gyane sadakatamam yasya tata bhutam yat sarva vedanta saram advitiya vastu tannishtam tadeka vishayam idam shri bhagavatam iti praktana padya stain anushangaha. The non-dual entity that embodies the essence of all Vedanta texts is the only topic, the heart of Srimad Bhagavatam. The tattva's identity is defined by the statement, Brahman is eternal existence and consciousness, unlimited. That is a statement that the Mayavadis take as their definition of the Absolute Truth from the Taittiriya Upanishad. Taittiriya? 400. No, it's, Taittiriya Upanishad. Which is, in that same section of Taittiriya Upanishad, it goes on to describe Ananda of Brahman and Rasa Vaisaha. That Absolute Truth is Rasa. So it's really not proper to understand this impersonally, but the Mayavadis go ahead and understand it impersonally anyway. But Jiva Goswami is taking this as an actual definition of the Absolute Truth. He continues, that this tattva is the only cause of the entire universe is stated in phrases such as, quote, hearing of which leaves nothing unheard, by discernment of which all that is to be discerned becomes known. And, dear boy, in the beginning there was only Sat, the eternal reality. That the intentions of this tattva are always fulfilled is expressed by the words, he glanced and desired, let me become many. The one characteristic of this tattva that most effectively helps one begin to understand its nature is that this tattva shares with the jiva its integral part, yet a separate spiritual entity, oneness in substance. This oneness is known from such statements as, you are that, tat tvamasi. The supreme is called Brahman because it is the greatest, brahattama. In terms of its essential self and its energies, in terms of its svarupa and its shaktis. Because even not looking at the shaktis, it's the biggest thing. It's the original thing that everything else is created from. So it's the greatest. But if you look at its qualities, it's got better and more qualities than everything else. So it's the greatest in terms of its qualities, its energies also. That's why it's called Brahman, not because it has no qualities, but because it has the most qualities, the best qualities. Therefore, it's called Brahman. Brahman, brim means to expand, not to be nothing or nowhere, or not to do anything, but to be expanded and be full with everything. That is what it means to be Brahman. Continuing, and so the jiva is spoken of in relationship with the supreme when it is said that the jiva accompanies that Brahman, and that Brahman enters matter along with this jiva soul. So jiva, Brahman are two different things. They have a relationship. Continuing, although the adjective this in the phrase this jiva indicates that the jiva is separate from Brahman, That the jiva is called soul indicates that he has a special relationship of substantial oneness with Brahman. In trance, Bhadarayana Vyas perceived all this reasoning, which establishes that the jiva is not absolutely one with the Supreme. The word Sri Bhagavatam in a preceding verse, verse 9 of that chapter, establishes that the verse under discussion, verse 12 of the chapter, indeed refers to Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, that whole section in the last chapter of the Bhagavatam is discussing Srimad Bhagavatam. So this statement is what the Bhagavatam is about. Kaivalyaika is only about the absolute, the non-dual absolute truth, which is Krishna. Continuing in 52.2. Yata janma pravritti kaschid griha guha varuda suryam vividishu katanchit gavaksha patitam suryamshu kanam darshayatva kenachid upadishyate asya sa itye tad amsha jyotik samana karataya tan maha jyotir mandalam anusandiyatam ityartas tadvat jivasya tata tad amshatvam chatada chintya shakti vishesha siddhatvainaiva paramatma sandarbe stapa yishyamaha. Suppose someone who has been kept prisoner in his house since birth wants to know what the sun is. He manages to observe the sun's rays coming through the small holes in the closed window shutters, and someone tells him, that is the sun. Behind this awareness lies the instruction. I have a problem here with the translation. Darshayatva is causative. So it doesn't mean that he manages somehow. He manages to observe, but that someone shows him. He doesn't notice until someone points it out to him. Look, there's a sun rays coming through the window holes. Can I mark that? I can't mark it. This file's the wrong file. Okay, hold on. Can you give me 30 seconds? Ah, I closed the file too. Okay. Okay, so I just had this grammatical mistake there. Someone else is showing it to him rather than he's seeing it on his own. Anyway, that person shows it to him, and then behind that, him being told that's the sun, behind this answer lies the instruction. From these small portions of light, which are one in substance with their source, you should be able to form some idea of the great fiery sphere of the sun. In the same way, the jiva is a portion of the Supreme by virtue of the Supreme's inconceivable special potencies. This we will prove later in the Paramatma Sandarbha. Tadeta 52.3. Tadeta jivadi lakshanamsha vishishtataya upanishadas tasya samshatvam api kvachit upadishyanti niramshatopadeshika shrutis tu kevalatan nishta atra kaivalyaika prayojanam iti chaturta padash chakaivalya padasya shudatva matra vachanatvena Shudatvasya cha shuddha bhakti tvena payavasanena priti sandarbe vyakhyastyate Sri Sutaha. In places, the Upanishads teach that the Supreme has parts, in terms of its being qualified by the jivas and other kinds of expansions. Shruti statements that say that the Supreme has no parts deal with Kevala, the exclusive oneness of the Supreme. So some statements talk about its parts, and some statements say that it doesn't have parts. It's just looking at the Supreme from in two different ways. In the fourth line of Bhagavatam 12.13.12, the phrase, the goal of this literature is exclusive oneness. There the word exclusive oneness, kaivalya, refers to unalloyed pureness. Perfect pureness, not being the only thing that exists. It's a different idea of kaivalya. Purely visuddhisattva is the idea. As we will explain later in the Priti Sandarbha, this state of pureness is ultimately pure bhakti. The verse under discussion was spoken by Sri Suta. The Mayavadis think that the perfect pureness, the pure of the pure, is impersonal Brahman. We say that the purest of the pure is pure bhakti, pure devotional service to Krishna. Commentary. The confidential purpose of the purport of the verse under discussion, 12.13.12, is sometimes understood by those confused by its terminology. Kaivalyaika prayojanam. It sounds Mayavari. Brahmatmaikatva and kaivalya may at first sound like references to impersonal merging into the existence of the Supreme. But to interpret Srimad Bhagavatam's view of the goal of life in such a way is to ignore everything the Bhagavatam has said in hundreds of previous chapters. The real meaning of the oneness of the Supreme and the finite souls and of the ultimate perfection of merging is found in the sublime mystery of devotional service. To reveal this mystery of bhakti to those able to understand its value is the deepest purpose of Srimad Bhagavatam, indeed of the original Vedas as well. So this statement in the very last chapter of the Bhagavatam is like a final exam. You know, do you understand the devotional message or are you still a Mayavadi? And if you're still a Mayavadi, you'll misunderstand this verse and flunk the test. It's given at the end, final exam. Continuing, the Upanishads teach that the Supreme is eternal, conscious, and unlimited, that he is the source of everything, and that he is the most important object of knowledge, because when his essence is known, all of his emanations are easily understood. Furthermore, his self-expansion into the duality of the material atmosphere is not an imposition of illusion upon him, but an intentional expression of his personal desire. He manifests his counterparts, the jivas, to enjoy reciprocating with them. The jivatma stands in a peculiar marginal relationship to the Supreme Atma, midway between the eternal world of spirit and the created world of matter. Because the jiva is an eternal living being, and the created, because the jiva is an eternal living being, he is one with the Supreme in a general way. As a specific individual, however, the jiva is perpetually distinct from the Supreme. Without separate individuality, there can be no true expression of love between the jivatma and the paramatma. In both the spiritual world and the material world, the Lord shares the company of his jivas. Anena jivatmananu pravishya nama rupe vyakara nani. Let me enter this world along with this jivatma and expand the manifestations of names and forms. That's the Lord speaking at the beginning of material creation, or at the beginning of a new cycle of material creation. It's a supersoul talking. Or Garbhadakshay Vishnu, who later expands into the supersoul Kshiradakshay Vishnu. He's speaking here. That's Chandogya Upanishad, sixth chapter. The jiva is anena, this, the visible self, whereas the Supreme is imperceptible within material existence. You can see him in the spiritual world, but in the material world it's very hard to see him. He's mostly invisible. But the jiva, by studying his own spiritual nature, can begin to learn the nature of the Supreme. Tat Tvamasi, you, the Jiva, are the same in substance with that unknown Supreme. It's called Tat. We don't give it a particular name. It's just that, who knows where, who knows what. So we refer to it just with a pronoun, Tat, that whatever it is. What's that whatever it is? It's you. You want to know what it's like? It's like you. You're a pure spirit, and you can experience yourself. So you can experience what Tat is by experiencing yourself. What is that? That is you. The Upanishadic, continuing, the Upanishadic passages that characterize Brahman as having no expansions simply focus on him in an abstract, in isolation, not paying attention to his personality and counterparts. Thus, these passages do not contradict the basic teaching of bhakti. For example, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad says, Nishkalam, Nishkriyam, Shantam, Niravadyam, Niranjanam. Brahman has no parts. It is inactive, undisturbed, uncontaminated, and untouched by anything else. Okay, but the Shvetashvatara Upanishad is teaching bhakti. Gyanamishra bhakti, but still it's bhakti. So, in other words, continuing, the personality of Godhead has no material aspects. He does not engage in material karma. He is free from the agitations of material desire, and he is never degraded by contact with maya. Therefore, you can call him Nishkalam, no parts, Nishkriyam, no activity, Shantam, peaceful, not doing anything, Niravadyam, nothing impure about him, Niranjanam, no entanglement. But that's actually describing the personality of Godhead. Throughout history, this most secret understanding of the Vedas has rarely been realized. But the Supreme Lord is exceptionally kind to the fallen souls of the modern age. He has appeared in the form of sound as Srimad Bhagavatam and directly as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. By the simple disciplines of chanting the holy names of God, accepting sacred food offered to him, and studying the Bhagavatam, any human being can take up bhakti yoga and uncover his natural love of God by Lord Chaitanya's causeless mercy. Here's the process, simple. Chant the holy names of God, take prasadam, and study the Bhagavatam. I don't see memorized Sanskrit sutras on the list, so that's secondary. The primary activities are Hare Krishna, prasadam, and Bhagavatam. Please let's not forget that. That's our prime activity. This morning, hardly anybody even came to prasadam. Okay, any discussion? If you're, I guess devotees aren't, some devotees aren't here, some are sick, but if you're so absorbed in studying the sutras that you don't even come to prasadam, maybe that's too much. Okay. Discussion? Dhammer? You? Okay. Anything?
I'm struggling with these parts. I found it hard to. I just want to know if most devotees are understanding or.
Are other devotees having similar problems understanding this? Yes. I don't know what to say. Maybe. It's complicated stuff.
I think it's complicated parts and maybe.
Socrates in the Republic suggests that you shouldn't study metaphysics until you're 30 years old. If you're young, maybe don't have it. It just doesn't strike you as much.
So I think that this, yeah.
I mean, I meant that sarcastically. Sorry. Yes.
It's a little bit difficult portions of this. Maybe we could ask to read before class ourselves, and then. When you read it, we can discuss more nicely. Because it's difficult to catch up all these points while you're just reading.
Well, you can prepare, yes. Anyway, we're getting near the end already. But as we move on into the Bhagavad Sandarbha, you think this is hard. Wait till they get to the second Sandarbha. Yes, you can study the night before and have your questions ready and try to figure out as much as you can before you come to the class. Because we don't have time to stop for everything, although if you have questions that are about what the text says, sure, we'll discuss them. And we can take as long as that requires. At least it's on the topic. So like, what do we have problem understanding here? Don't worry. I mean, I'm sure when you say it, everyone's going to realize, oh yeah, I don't understand that either. Too much, too fast? Okay, are we going too fast? Well, the thing is, if I were to stop in the middle of an anuccheda, ask for questions, then we'd get off on all sorts of tangents and lose our focus. So that's why I'm not asking for questions until we get to the end of the anuccheda. But if there's anything in the anuccheda and the commentary that isn't understandable, we should discuss it and maybe make a change. So actually, it would help us if you could tell us what's not understood. I'm sorry? No. Okay, well, if you want to bring... You can bring questions the next day about what was discussed the day before. That's okay. That won't count as irrelevant. If you want to figure out what you need to discuss, and we could do it tomorrow. How's that? We can even start the class asking whether there are any questions about the previous anuccheda. Okay, but we try to stick to what's being discussed in the anuccheda rather than, you know, elaborate on it. We got 6 sandarbhas. We don't want to turn it into 30 sandarbhas. We got 6 are enough. So we don't need to expand it into all sorts of investigations and all sorts of things. Try to focus on the things that Jiva Goswami is talking about. Okay. Okay, can you give us some questions tomorrow morning? Tomorrow? Yeah, I mean, you can study. Look at this on the chain and look at it a little bit slower. And maybe if you read it a little slower, you won't have any problem. But if you still have problems, let us know what they are. Okay? Because there's going to be, I don't know about thousands, but there's at least going to be hundreds of devotees reading this book. And a lot of them are going to run into similar problems. We should try to help them. I mean, even Jayadwaitamaraj, when I gave him the Sarvasambhadani part, he first of all said, I can't edit this. Yeah, he didn't want to edit it. He says it's too hard. So, I mean, even he had a hard time with it. And I just tried to translate it the best I could to the extent I understood it. I don't claim to fully understand it either. Sure, Prabhu.
For myself, it's not any one particular sentence that is incomprehensible, but it's just so many different things, and you don't really know the context, you lose track. It's kind of like when I first started reading Bhagavatam, it's like, who's talking to who, and what's going on, and where are we in the story? Is Sutta Goswami talking? Is Maitreya? For me, that's kind of what it's like a little bit. You come to class, and you don't really, like, you're not clear like where he is in the argument. What is the argument? What's the point of the argument? What's he trying to prove?
Well, maybe because you're jumping in, having missed a part of it, or forgotten what we were doing the day before.
Possible.
Yeah.
I mean, if that may be one reason why, because even Damodar Prabhu is saying he's not able to. catch what's happening.
Okay, you know, this is the hard part. We're going to be through with it, and the rest of it will be easier. In the second Sandarbha, I tried to do more orienting, more reminding the reader what we're talking about and what went before and what, you know, like that. I didn't do it that much here, but I did try in second Sandarbha to help the reader understand the line of reasoning, keep track of it. Yeah.
Is there any something like textbook on that Vasandarbha, or something like survey or some material about this structure of that Vasandarbha and so on? Maybe somebody already prepared it and they could use it.
There are a couple of scholarly books, but they're done by non-devotees. I think maybe one devotee once wrote a doctoral or a master's thesis on the Sandarbhas. It was a devotee. But the rest of the books about the Sandarbhas, there are a few of them, but they're written by non-devotees. We have Stuart Elpman's translation of the Tattva Sandarbha with his own commentary. But he's an Ekadandi Mayavadi sannyasi. He went to the University of Pennsylvania to get his PhD after being American, but he became a Ramakrishna Mayavadi sannyasi. I think Ramakrishna Mission. And his professor said, okay, you're an Advaitavadi. I'm going to give you a challenge. You should translate for your thesis. You should translate and explain Jiva Goswami's Tattva Sandarbha. Because he was a Mayavadi, his teacher gave him the Sandarbha just to give him a challenge. And so it's a good scholarly book, but he just doesn't understand a lot of things from the devotional point of, you know, the actual devotional viewpoint. He doesn't understand it. And he's unfair to Jiva Goswami. He criticizes him unfairly for minor things. And then there's some lady professor wrote a general book about Jiva Goswami and his works, but it's not very profound. It doesn't have much valuable information in it. I don't know much else. You want a simple introduction to Tattva Sandarbha. Maybe someone here can write it. I'm having my hands full just putting this out in the original form. Someone wants to write an introduction to the, you know, a simple presentation of it, please do it.
Something like basic structure of Tattva Sandarbha and some basic points and...
That should be in the introduction. The introduction that we published, which hasn't been written yet, should do that. Should, you know, explain the structure and the contents of the book. That will be there in the introduction, which I had to write soon.
But we already had this Satya Narayana's book. Is there any in his book something similar?
I don't think so. I don't think there's much of an introduction there. Do you have the book? Satya Narayana's? We have it in the library? Oh, okay. Well, you can read his. I see what he says. Yes. But he didn't write an introduction in the beginning? He doesn't have an introduction? Study guide. Okay. But we can try to give some kind of study guide. The introduction can be as long as we wanted, and it can serve as a kind of study guide. And we can put it into this book. If you want, I'd be very glad if you give me some suggestions of what should go into it. I haven't started to write it yet, the introduction. So if anybody has any suggestions what the introduction should contain, maybe you can send me an email message so I won't forget it and make suggestions. What do you think needs to be explained? And then we can make up for the difficulty of the text a little bit by helping the readers in the introduction. It's like the Tattva Sandarbha gets tough at parts. Other parts are not so difficult. It's the other Sandarbhas, or the second and third Sandarbha, that are like full speed ahead, very tough all the way through. And not much you can do about it. You know, I don't want to cut corners and simplify. You know, leave out things that he said. So all I can do is give what he said and try to be accurate, but understandable, and then try to, as much as possible, explain it in the commentary without getting off on, you know, into different topics. I think I did a better job of that in the second Sandarbha, of helping the reader follow what's going on. That was my main intention in writing the comment. See, the commentary here on the Tattva Sandarbha is simply a paraphrase of what Baladev Vidyabhushan says, that he was writing for an audience 300 years ago who know things, you know, were better educated in these things than we are. Whereas the other Sandarbhas, we don't have that commentary. And so I started from scratch, and my main endeavor in the commentary in the second Sandarbha was to, help the reader follow what's going on, and things that Jiva Goswami mentions that people may not know what they are, I try to explain them. That's basically all I do. A little bit of preaching, but mostly just orientating and explaining ideas, concepts. I didn't do that much. This manuscript is old. I did it 11 years ago. So I figured out to do that when I got to the second Sandarbha. And it was more required in the second Sandarbha. So rather than at this point start rewriting the commentaries, I think we just have to try to supplement everything in the introduction. If it's a long introduction, as long as it's substantial, not just a lot of fluff, then we can make it as long as necessary.
So it seems that we need something like commentary in introduction. So.
Yeah. Yes.
So in this case, it would be more understandable. In this case, it would be more understandable.
I hope so. Anyway. You can help us by coming up with some specific questions about what is difficult, what's confusing. We got a sense that there's confusion, but let's pinpoint the actual things that are confusing. So for tomorrow, can you come up with a few things? And we'll start the class with that. Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. And therefore, I don't expect that this is going to be as popular as Brihad Bhagavatamrita. It's not going to have the same audience.
Whenever I go to Vrindavan, just or they see me, or even next to Krishna Varan, if someone from Ras Bihari Lal, they see, says, please ask what Prabhu to send or organize. We need Brihad Bhagavatam. Everyone who comes to Lakhazan, they want books. No one has.
I'm on the 6th, it's the beginning of the BBT meeting. I actually will ask that to be put on the agenda.
When I passed by Krishna Bhavan temple, they said, we want all the volumes. Lord Bazar, he said, any price, just give us any price. We always want so much for the last 2 years.
Okay.
I was just mentioning.
Thank you.